markets go up and down. What's important is that they are continuous and functioning. Mm-hmm. In my 35, 40-year career, when people panic is when you're not able to have price discovery, when markets close, when there is the threat of gating, things like that. So you know, we are just concerned that the market is continuously functioning, that there's a buyer, sellers, we can match them up.
Is it your belief that the volume of ships going through the Strait of Hormuz will be improving immediately from now?
It is my belief that as soon as it is militarily possible, the U.S. Navy, perhaps with an international coalition, will be escorting vessels through.
And that came up just now in the Situation Room.
Your words, not mine. In terms of investing, I tell everyone, you have to know what level of risk you're willing to take. You have to do what you're comfortable with. And you just shouldn't get out over your skis. Like that's the main thing. You never want to have to sell at the bottom. You never want to find yourself like chasing at the top.
Is America out over its skis in the Middle East right now?
Absolutely not.
Welcome to the Master Investor Podcast with me, Wilfred Frost, where we celebrate and learn from the success of the greatest investors, business leaders, and politicians in the world, giving you, our listeners, the edge. The Master Investor Podcast is sponsored by BNY Investments, LSEG, and Interactive Brokers. Please do remember the views expressed in this podcast are for general information purposes only. Nothing in the podcast constitutes a financial promotion, investment advice, or a personal recommendation. More on that in the show notes. My guest today is the single most important person in the world of global finance, the US Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent. He's also one of the greatest investors around today. He was at Soros Fund Management for 20 years in the 90s and 2000s, rising to be CIO, before founding his own hedge fund, Key Square, in 2015, amongst many other roles before his current one. Mr. Secretary, it's an honor to be here in the Treasury with you. Welcome to the Master Investor Podcast, and thank you for having me.
Good, and welcome to the Cash Room.
It's a fantastic room. You were telling me the history. You used to host, in fact, inauguration balls for the president.
We did. It was a much smaller affair there, but it's a grand room.
It's certainly very spacious for a one-on-one interview, and it's, as I said, such a treat to be here. So much I want to get to, including your investment career and your current political role. Before diving into that, there was a quote in my preparation that you gave to the FT in October 2025 that really jumped out to me. You said, "Unlike most of my predecessors, I have a very healthy skepticism of elite institutions and elite opinion, whereas I think they didn't. But I have a healthy regard for the market." Is that a sort of guiding principle for you as you switched from investing to politics?
Well, I think in investing, it was always a guiding principle that the crowd is right 85 or 90% of the time, and that's the momentum. But it's really that when things turn, or when you could imagine a different outcome than the consensus, is when you can really make a lot of money. You know, if we think back to impossible for a country to leave the exchange rate mechanism, you know, there's unlimited support there. If we go back to the U.S. Housing crisis in the 2000s, you know, there was just this mantra, well, the U.S. has never experienced a down national housing market, so nothing to worry about. So, you know, I think that to the extent I've had success in my career, some of the really big successes have been taking the other side of elite opinion. You know, Japan can never change. They are mired in deflation and disinflation. The lost decades are going to continue. And, you know, I met this fellow called Abe and thought that he was a catalyst for change. So, you know, as a result, I'm always looking like, how could the consensus be wrong? How is the framing wrong? You know, where are we wrong here? You know, who would have believed, other than Ronald Reagan, that the Berlin Wall could come down?
Mm-hmm. And I guess with that healthy respect for the market that you have, you've brought that into your political role. Which market is the most important? Is it ultimately the bond market that you have to respect the most?
It's ultimately the bond market. And the U.S. Treasury market is the deepest, most liquid, and most solid in the world. We manage it out of this building, and we are the guardians of the Treasury market. And we try to be very transparent, and we also try to make sure that the market itself is very resilient on an operational and a settlement basis. Whether it was post-Liberation Day last year, whether it's during this Iranian conflict now, you know, the market is smoothly functioning, settling well. We are very concerned about it at all times.
In your time as Treasury Secretary, how many times has the bond market given you pause for thought, at least, or giving you a little worry? Just in April last year, was that a moment? January a bit this year?
No. What I was saying is that's when there could have been operational difficulties. You know, I think about the bond market every day. You know, I've been.
And there's no moments when it scared you in your time as Treasury Secretary, the movements?
No. Because markets go up and down. What's important is that they are continuous and functioning. Mm-hmm. In my 35, 40-year career, when people panic is when you're not able to have price discovery, when markets close, when there is the threat of gating, things like that. So we are just concerned that the market is continuously functioning, there's a buyer, sellers, we can match them up.
Diving into the background of your career a bit more, I've learned in my preparation, you've thought about being a lifeguard, you thought about being a computer scientist and a journalist. Obviously, you went into finance and started as a banks analyst at Brown Brothers, which I hadn't previously been aware of. I love that, having been the bank's lead banks reporter at CNBC. Settled on global macro investing.
Yeah, I will point out, I was a lifeguard.
You were a lifeguard,
yeah,
sorry.
I was a lifeguard.
But did you nearly do it long-term?
No. That wasn't a long-term career. You age out pretty quickly, both because of the physical and the sun.
Well, either way, I hadn't been aware of the fact that you were a lifeguard. And
one thing you learn as a lifeguard, drowning people will try to pull you down.
Wow.
So,
and has that been a metaphor that has come into your investing life or your political life?
Sure. Both.
Where in politics is it?
Well, sometimes when a drowning person's trying to pull you down, sometimes you have to give them a little nudge to be able to save them.
But still ultimately always committed to saving them.
Always committed to getting things to shore. And many drowning people can just be saved by things stand up. So a lot of times people are panicked in the water.
Well, I'm looking forward to getting in, maybe coming back to that metaphor when we get into some of your views on different countries at the moment. Dwelling on being a global macro investor, you alluded to this a tiny bit in your first answer, but I've heard you talk about it before, where you need, as a macro global particularly investor, you have to be able to predict what's going to happen in the world. But really importantly, to make money, you have to identify when those predictions are also mispriced. Is that the key aspect to make money?
Exactly. Yeah, I found everyone asks me, well, what do you think got you ready for your career? And I go all the way back to my childhood, because I mentioned it in interviews before. My father was an incredible collector of science fiction novels, and probably had the largest collection in South Carolina, not a high bar, but he'd read those to me. As a child, I always say, I could point to Alpha Centauri on a map before I could Chicago. So, but with that, a lot, you have to be able to imagine different worlds. And with finance, could you imagine a different state of the world? What the legendary macro investor Bruce Kovner is quoted many times as saying, I have the ability to imagine a different state of the world and believe it could happen. So I think the question you're asking is, can you imagine a different state of the world? And then you're also trying to predict the when. When, why, how, and then how would you implement it?
This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. Building wealth starts with the right broker, and Interactive Brokers helps you reach your goals with powerful tools, global market access, low costs, and unmatched financial strength. That's why the best informed investors choose IBKR. Learn more at ibkr.com/masterinvestor. Let's dive into one of your famous trades, if we will. You mentioned ERM, but I kind of was more interested actually in your yen trade. 2010s to early 2020s, the yen was very strong. It was below 80. You rode it for a decade as it weakened to 150 or so. What did you see in the 2011 or 12, whenever it was you started the trade? What did you see then that others didn't see?
Well, and this goes back to timing, that I think in psychology, a big psychological bias is called endowment bias. So you've worked on something, so you want to implement it. And I think one of the strengths my team and I have always had is the ability to put something back on the shelf, do an immense amount of work, and then just say, now's not the time. And it was that with the Japanese yen. I think I went to Japan the first time in 1990. So I was there plus or minus 6-9 months for the peak in the Nikkei. I lived at the Okura Hotel, I think for 3 months. Imagine 1990, the price was about $500 a night. In 2011, it was $350 a night. So you know, that told you about the malaise there. So I was very familiar with Japan. You know, I'd seen the up, I saw the down, then you know, I saw the stasis for a long time. And in 2011, right after Fukushima, and you know, terrible tragedy, tsunami, tidal wave, near nuclear meltdown, easy to remember, it's 3/11/11 when that happened. And I thought, well, maybe there's a catalyst here because the Japanese government demanded that the nuclear reactors be switched off. So if one was thinking of being short the yen, you were pushing against a very, very large current account surplus, about 3% of GDP. But when the Japanese switched off the nuclear reactors, they had to start importing more fossil fuels, and it took the current account to a deficit. But nothing really happened. The yen was kind of bouncing around between 78, 82, and 83. And then a contact in Japan, great fellow, Funabashi-san, Japanese journalist, thinker, policy person, called and said, there's this fellow called Abe. He had been the prime minister before. He's going to come back. I think he could be the prime minister, and he's going to campaign on restoring the Japanese economy, economic strength, his national strength, and on a reflationary platform. And then kind of everything fell into line because I believe there were three board seats opening on the Bank of Japan. Bank of Japan had been a group of deflationists or disinflationists. So Prime Minister was going to have the opportunity to reconstitute the board, including the governor.
Yep.
So you know, everything kind of fell into line.
Sorry, the president wants you right away.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Well, as you heard there, we were interrupted as the secretary was pulled away by the president to join him in the Situation Room in the White House. We picked up our conversation again a little over an hour later. Mr. Secretary, I have to say, it's a first, I'm sure a last as well, that an interviewee's been pulled away to go to the Situation Room. How was the president? Was he stressed?
No, the president is in great spirits. The Iranian mission is proceeding well ahead of schedule. And you know, I have to tell you, Wolf, that I have a teenager who's considering military service. And I could give this team my highest compliment, from President Trump to the head of the Joint Chiefs, to the Secretary of War. I would say that I would trust my child's life in their hands.
Well, your child sounds like a brave person, Mr. Secretary, and we want to come to all of those details in a couple moments. But if I may, I want to pick up to where we were, which you just explained your successful trade on the yen, and how you bought into the policies that Abe was going to deliver and what it would do to the market. I was really struck by something I heard you say on the Capital Allocators podcast in November 2024. You said that your boss then, George Soros, asked you about whether Abenomics and the policies would work for Japan and the economy. And you said this, you say, I have no idea, but it will be the market ride of a lifetime. Of course, you're right. You made a lot of money in that trade. I guess now you've switched from investor to policymaker, judging actually whether a policy will deliver or not, as opposed to how things are priced, is all that matters.
Well, and to circle back with the Japanese, the Abenomics, all three arrows, have been a fantastic success. So it started out as a market success, and then over time, like with all things Japanese, they were very deliberate and probably took a little more than Westerners would have liked. But the things that they've done to restructure the economy, restructure the investment environment in terms of bringing up shareholders' rights, return on capital, what they called womenomics, bringing women into the workforce. There's now mobility among labor in terms of people switching jobs. So they've done a fantastic job of restructuring the economy.
And now, as in your role as policymaker rather than as an investor, do you have to ignore what the market is pricing and focus on what will actually deliver?
No, I still find information, that there is information value in the market sometimes. But what I'm trying to do is, for call it 30, 35 years, my job was to have my ear up against the door where the policymakers were meeting, maybe trying to lift myself the transom and figure out what they were going to do. Now that I'm in the room, we try to figure out what can be done, what should be done, what will be done, and then how will the economy and the market react. Mm-hmm. And whenever I'm out speaking during a policy time, whether post-Liberation Day or on the economy in general, now with the Iranian conflict, what I try to do is think about, if I were sitting in my old seat as a policy person, what guidance can I give to the market, to the U.S. population, to other policymakers around the world, to give good framing for what we're doing without giving away any material non-public information.
Was the transition hard from an unbelievably successful, wealthy investor, your own boss, to having a boss again?
You got to remember, for most of my career, I worked with Stan Druckenmiller, and he was really my mentor. So, and we have a great group with the cabinet. And I think that especially in stress times like this, people have really come together. I just came from the Situation Room, and we have a series of morning meetings. And everyone, I thought the cabinet was performing at a very high level. Everyone has stepped up that level unbelievably. I would say, in a way, I was training for this job for a long time, because before, when I went to the G7 or the G20 meetings, I know the central bankers. I knew the finance ministers. Just before, I was someone who they were trying to placate as an investor. Now I'm speaking to them as a peer and a colleague. Mm-hmm.
This episode of the Master Investor Podcast is brought to you by LSEG, the leading global financial markets, infrastructure, data, and analytics provider. To learn more about how LSEG connects businesses, investors, and markets worldwide, visit lseg.com. Hi guys, it's Wilf. I hope you're enjoying this episode. Just a quick reminder to please hit follow or subscribe on your podcast or video app so that you never miss an episode. And if you've got time, please do give us a 5-star rating and leave us a comment. It really helps other people find the podcast too. Now, back to the episode.
Let's touch about what I'm sure you were discussing in the Situation Room, details that I'm sure came up. WTI is obviously around $94, $95 as we're recording. It started the year under 60, briefly peaked at 114, 115 earlier this week. What level is too much for the U.S. economy to take?
Well, I don't think it's the level. I think it's probably the duration. If you recall, even in 2008, we had the record spike up to, I believe,
140-something.
147. So I think it's the duration, and I think that President Trump's energy policies have insulated the U.S. quite a bit. We're record liquids production with both crude and natural gas. Now, natural gas prices have been little affected, and a lot of that goes into the energy, the household bills. So, and again, president is focused on his mission of the wiping out the Iranian missile capabilities, their manufacturing capabilities, their air force, their navy, and their ability to project power beyond their borders and to cut off the head of the snake as the leading architect of global terrorism.
You've obviously pledged to help in the insurance process for ships, with Lloyd's of London pausing on that detail. Big announcements in the last 24 hours about releases from strategic reserves from both the IEA and you as well. It hasn't worked in the short term on oil prices.
Well, no. Let's back up. The market lives in the future. So we got the oil spike on Sunday night, and I think maybe at one point we were up about the $30, and then overnight, the FT published that the IEA was considering a 300 to 400 million barrel release. Mm-hmm. And then we had the biggest single reversal in one day history that day. So it was already priced in. So we had a G7 finance ministers meeting on Monday where it was discussed, energy meeting, ministers meeting yesterday, and then, Tuesday, and then yesterday, I was in the Oval with the president for the leaders meeting, and the leaders confirmed that it would in fact be a 400 million barrel release, which is the largest in history.
Yeah, I fully accept that. The news of a potential release brought prices down from their peak, but, mm-hmm. but clearly we're still up 50% or so from where we started the year. I guess my point is, are you starting to think, if this does keep persisting as it is, that the Navy has to go into the Strait of Hormuz to help ships get through, which would have a big effect?
That was always in our planning, that there's the chance that U.S. Navy or perhaps an international coalition will be escorting oil tankers through. There are, in fact, tankers coming through now. Iranian tankers, I believe some Chinese flag tankers have come through. So we know that they have not mined the straits.
And was that what you were just discussing in the Situation Room?
We were discussing a plethora of things.
And is it your belief that the volume of ships going through the Strait of Hormuz will be improving immediately from now?
It is my belief that as soon as it is militarily possible, the U.S. Navy, perhaps with an international coalition, will be escorting vessels through.
And that came up just now in the Situation Room.
Your words, not mine.
But again, Wilf, we've
been planning for this. We've done scenario analysis for months, for weeks, leading into this. So,
but it's a prospect in the coming days then?
It is a prospect as soon as we have complete control of the skies and are degrading they have no air force. The Navy is sunk literally and figuratively, and the munitions factories, the rebuilding capabilities for the missiles, the completely degraded. So as soon as it is possible for safe passage, we will do it. And, you know, again, with the DFC insurance product, this was something that we had already anticipated. And you know, because Lloyd's does call force majeure and the policies drop away. So we think that $20 billion in insurance for tankers going into and out of the Gulf will be enough to ensure a circular insurance program.
Tons more to get to on your policy long term. A couple more in this area, if I may. What is the running cost at the moment of this war? $1 billion a day? $10 billion a day?
I'm not keeping the running costs because, you know, in the U.S. we separate Treasury from OMB, so that's why I'm the Treasury Secretary, not the Finance Minister.
Ballpark, though.
A number came out today, in the public number that was released today was about $11 billion thus far.
Over a couple of weeks. And how long, as you look long-term at America's finances, how long are you planning for this conflict to continue for?
Again, $11 billion is a lot of money, but you know, we have cushions built in, and you know, it's not something that we have to worry about this horizon.
There's no chance you could be knocking on the president's door to say we have to pause on this, we can't afford it.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You know, what we've seen last year was continued and increasing foreign interest in U.S. Treasuries. U.S. Treasuries had their best year since 2022, and we were the only G7 bond market with lower yields last year on the 10-year.
Finally on this, you issued a 30-day waiver on Indian refiners who had been prevented from buying Russian oil. They got a 30-day waiver on that. Is it a matter of regret to you that Russia is benefiting from this conflict?
Well, I think it's an inevitability, and that's why we gave a 30-day waiver, because the Russian barrels are on the water, and it is a quick source of for the Indian refineries. You know, the other way to think about it is those barrels are going to end up in China anyway. But
is it a shame that Russia benefits?
It is unfortunate, and we hope that it will be in a micro period that they will benefit.
Let's touch on China next then. Obviously, you're due to travel to meet the Chinese in Paris in the coming days. A lot of people look at some of the U.S. foreign policy actions and wonder how you connect the dots. Venezuela probably eased oil prices, whereas Iran's done the opposite. But is one thing that links them that China suffers from U.S. action both in Venezuela and in Iran? And was that part of the design of the action?
Well, nothing was done with China in mind. We're looking after U.S. interest. You know, with U.S. interest, we had a near-failed narco state in the Western Hemisphere. President Trump has made it clear that we want to protect our neighborhood. We have a substantial movement that over the past few years of our Latin American neighbors, from very far left, a la Bolivia, Chile, back to center right, maybe far right governments who want to embrace market principles and want to be allies of the U.S. So I went down to Argentina last spring, and because I was in a U.S. government aircraft, we had to fly around Bolivia because Bolivia had closed U.S. airspace to U.S. military aircraft. Now, Bolivia's our ally. Chile had briefly gone far left. Now that they are right, the president-elect has already said that he wants to be an ally of the U.S. again. So I think this is a generational opportunity in the Western Hemisphere to show the benefits of being allies with the U.S., both militarily, economically. And, you know, I would go back, you know, Iran, that the military operation here was to keep them from being able to ring fence with their missile capabilities, the ability to create an atomic weapon inside of Iran, because, you know, that what is being done now, imagine if Iran had had two or three times these armaments in a year or 18 months.
This episode of the Master Investor Podcast with Wilfred Frost is sponsored by BNY Investments, a trusted partner for many, delivering financial solutions to investors and institutions worldwide. This sponsorship does not constitute financial advice.
Let's touch on the Fed and what the domestic policy should be long term, but in the short term. Does the situation with the oil price change your outlook of how soon they should be easing?
Again, there's a balance here. I think the Fed is worried about maybe the energy component triggering inflationary expectations. On the other hand, it'll be the duration here to see how much it slows the economy. And is that slowdown permanent? Or is it just potential energy that can turn into kinetic energy within the economy, and, you know, we will bounce back quickly after that? And, you know, the other thing that I think is important to know here is that if the oil price was below 60 at the beginning of the year, once this conflict is over and, you know, resolved in favor of the U.S., I think there's a chance we can move to a substantially lower oil price regime over the medium term.
A different question as it relates to the Fed. I mean, this is hypothetical, but if we were in a scenario, I mean, I think if you look at the U.S. long bond yields, you've done a remarkable job in light of a lot of challenges, medium and short term, in keeping long yields down, and your debt management has been down to that. More short-term issuance. If you were hypothetically in a situation where the Fed had to hike rates, would you issue more long debt again instead?
Again, we are collaborating with the Fed in terms of Treasury handles debt management. I think what you're asking is, would the Fed maybe go back to QE? I don't know. That's their decision, but I think we're such a long way from that, it's not even worth talking about.
Let's talk more long-term about the Fed. You are an Anglophile, we'll maybe come to that. You've spent a lot of time in the UK. Do you admire the Bank of England model more than the model you have here? And there's a couple of things to point to there. Well, you're going to jump in.
Well, again, they're very different institutions. That the Fed wears many hats. Right. And the Fed is a much bigger, much more sprawling organization with the regional banks, with the regional bank presidents. You know, the board is much bigger, and then that gets constrained into voters. You know, the Bank of England has, you know, has separated. There's a monetary policy committee, then there's an operating committee. Only the governor is on both. That you know, we call upon our Fed to do a lot. You know, in terms of monetary policy, in terms of regulatory policy, you know, and then just the sprawling organization is...
I guess there's a couple of things in mind that I was particularly pointing to. One is the Fed directly, the Bank of England directly reports to the Chancellor and to the government as opposed to the legislature. For extraordinary measures like QE, the Chancellor of the Exchequer actually has to approve that, even if, though it's assumed that they will automatically. And the inflation target is actually a range, 2% plus or minus 1. Are those factors sort of factors you'd like to embrace?
If we work backwards there is an inflation target, and I don't know how many letters All it requires is the governor to write the chancellor a letter and explain away why they haven't met the target. And look, I'm old enough to remember, too, when the chancellor actually set the rate. And I believe
before 97.
Yep. And it was both. And same with the Bank of Japan. So Bank of Japan and Bank of England actually separated themselves from the government at the latest point.
And is those kind of things you'd like to move back towards here?
No, not at all. And you know, in terms of QE, I actually believe that the Bank of England's QE policy was better than the Fed's, because you know I think extraordinary measures should only happen in extraordinary times. And the Bank of England stepped in. I think they've stepped in twice in the past few years, once during the early days of COVID. I don't remember the exact timing, but you know, let's say March, April, maybe May, and stabilize the smooth operation of the gilt market, and then they moved away. The Fed continued buying for years afterwards, mm-hmm. and I believe that that's one of the things that got us the great inflation, 22 and 23.
I wanted to touch on gold. The U.S. has a lot of gold, but it's valued at a price that is long since outdated, $42 an ounce, and we're currently at $5,000 plus. I know you and Kevin Warsh have ideas around reducing the size of the Fed balance sheet, but you also don't want to create a liquidity crisis. Would revaluing the gold and at the same time sterilizing that provide an opportunity to sell off the assets you don't want without creating a liquidity crisis?
No, I think those are very, very independent. I think if you're thinking about changing the balance sheet, you know, I think that's well in the future. The Fed would have to signal that well in advance, and you know, if they move from one regime to another in terms of reserves, you know, that's going to take time. And I think we're also going to have to step back and look at how has banking regulation since the GFC affected the size of the balance sheet, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of the interbank market, in terms of the necessity for the Fed to hold reserves as opposed to the you know a skinnier reserve model where the banks got their reserves from one another.
In terms of the Fed, you turned down the role of Fed chair, wanted to stay as Treasury Secretary. Why is Treasury Secretary a better job?
Well, you have a musical that was written about the first Treasury Secretary. There's never been a musical about a Fed chair, and I'd
like it. I'm not sure many people would.
I enjoy the interaction with the cabinet, and Fed chair is a different kind of public service. I've wanted to do public service since I was a young person, and this is you're really in it. You get called to the Situation Room. You're part of the cabinet. You're part of the policy making agenda. You know, I think of the Federal Reserve really as kind of guardians of the dollar, the reserve policy, maybe I'd like to do it in the future, but I think now we're in an extraordinary moment. There's so many things that need to be done by the Treasury Secretary to ensure dollar dominance, to ensure that, you know, one thing we haven't talked about is this building runs the sanctions regime. Mm-hmm. So in terms of maintaining that in a fulsome way, so there's a big national security component. And then in terms of, you know, managing the debt, and how do we think about that interacting with the Congress for the future?
I want to come to all of that in a second. One final question on markets, which is, you know, private credit's getting a lot of focus at the moment. We've spoken about the importance of the bond market. We've spoken about stepping into the oil market with the release. If there's problems that unfold in private credit, is that on those people that have exposure there? If they enjoyed the upside when it was going well, do they have to take the downside?
Well, that's why it's called the shadow banking system. It's not the banking system. So, you know, my area of concern is how does, and I don't mean that I am concerned, but what I'm responsible for is how does this shadow banking system interact with the regulated banking system, with the regulated insurance industry. And you know, again, we're seeing, to use a Britishism, some wobbles. And, you know, as we see these wobbles here, you know, there's nothing that tells me that shadow banking is having a systemic problem. But we are monitoring any relationships between the regulated entities. Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to the special relationship and developments there. We've touched on this already. You've lived in the UK before for many years, still go back there a lot. President Trump said last week he's not happy with the UK. He said Keir Starmer is no Winston Churchill. You were speaking about that and what he said in the Oval Office about Spain and the UK last week. And you said that Spain had put American lives at risk. Did Keir Starmer do the same?
That we delayed being able to fully implement the military plan. And, you know, I think that the main concern was the use of base Diego Garcia, and the USB-2s had to do a 37-hour round trip rather than, I think it's about a three and a half hour round trip. So, you know, constantly refueling over. So, you know, I think any delay, causes an increase in risk. And again, you know, President Trump is the commander in chief of the U.S. forces. And, you know, again, being in the Situation Room with him, that he so solemnly takes that, the leadership role, mm-hmm. in terms of his commitment to maintaining the lives of our service people, that anything that upsets that upsets him. And I think that's what got the very strong reaction.
But just to clarify, you said of the Spanish, anything that slows down our ability to engage puts American lives at risk. The Spanish put American lives at risk. So did the UK do that too?
I think we have a great historical relationship, and I think we'll get it back on track.
How unhappy is President Trump with Prime Minister Starmer right now?
Belatedly, the Prime Minister offered to put resources in the region. I believe that there are resources in the region, and we have a long-term relationship. There will be some bumps in the road. I think we will eventually get back on track.
Have you heard any discussions of the King and Queen's visit due in the spring being canceled?
Not at all.
In terms of relations more broadly over the last year and a half, and trade coming into that, you announced more tariff investigations yesterday under Section 301 of the 1974 Trade Act, targeted countries like the EU, a group of the EU, Switzerland, Singapore, Korea, Norway, the list goes on, a lot of allies there. Interesting timing, given that you're at war. It is now not a moment where you want to make sure all of your allies are on side?
Well, look, I think if going back to the tariff level that we previously had is going to take an ally offside, then they weren't allies. And we're operating now with a global 10% tariff. And I can tell you that the allies and all the countries that have done the trade deals with us have all come and said, we like our trade deal. We want to stick with that. So I think this is a good opportunity for me to explain any misperception about these investigations. These investigations are part of the normal course of business. The Supreme Court ruled that the president does not have the ability to use IEEPA tariffs, the emergency power, to apply tariffs. But the Section 301, which President Trump used in his first term, have been challenged more than 4,000 times in court. So all we're doing is reconstructing the tariffs under a different authority. That, you know, I would expect that everyone just goes back to the deal they had within the 150 days that we're allowed to use the Section 122 tariff.
Yes, there was Section 301. Section 122, would that mean that the UK is going to go up from 10% to 15%?
Again, Section 122 right now is still at 10.
It's still at 10. I guess the broad point, you're saying that it's putting tariffs back to where they were, but not to where they were a few years ago for allies. Mm-hmm. and an interesting time in the middle of trying to get people on side. I guess when you've had these conversations with G7 finance ministers in the last week to coordinate policy on strategic reserves of oil and petroleum, did you approach that thinking it would have been more helpful to have a more friendly, conciliatory relationship with those people?
Everyone knew. We had telegraphed well in advance that since the Supreme Court hearing, that we believe that the Supreme Court will rule in our favor, but in case it doesn't, be advised, this is how we are going to do it. So we'd had a substantial communications policy in advance. We told everyone, this is how we will reconstruct the tariff wall. And you know, I think everyone's well briefed and well aware of it.
I guess in the last week or two, we've been reminded of US policy that might be taking a step forwards without allies necessarily all coming on board. We talked about the clashes with Keir Starmer. I've heard you say very often, and the president say it too, that America first doesn't mean America alone. That is your intention and your aim from all of your policies. Do you ever have conversations with your counterparts that makes you worried that that choice won't be available to you? That America alone is starting to be how they see the actions that you're taking?
Well, I think you're seeing, as I said, I was in the Oval Office for the G7 leaders call, and the G7 leaders, they were all pretty much rallying around what the U.S. is doing, congratulating us for taking out this Iranian cancer on the world. And you know, they're more concerned about how does it proceed. We're seeing what may be an international coalition in terms of the Straits of Hormuz, that many countries have offered their minesweepers, should it be necessary for detection. And you know, the other thing, too, because I don't think, in terms of our allies, there's anyone in the world that who wanted the Iranian regime as it currently was constituted and the power it projected to continue. What we're also seeing, too, is the Arab nations that in the Gulf, they are shocked by the Iranian attack on them. And you know, I think that they've gotten a rude awakening that imagine an Iran that was two or three times stronger than they were 12 or 14 days ago, you know, on February 28th.
As we start to wrap up, Mr. Secretary, I know we're nearly out of time. You've described in the past your old boss, your old mentor, Stan Druckenmiller, as the best investor you've ever worked with. And I think you've described Warren Buffett as the best stock picker you've ever worked with. And you've reflected, I think, on the past on his two rules of investing. Number one being don't lose money. Number two being don't forget rule number one. And spoken about how you have to earn the right to be able to take risk. You have to stay in the game. Based on how big your chip stack is, you'll make different decisions. Is it fair to say that the size of America's chip stack today is smaller than it was a decade or two ago?
No, I would think it's the opposite. That I think we, you know, we have this leadership, we have energy dominance, that if we'd been where we were a few decades ago in terms of importing energy as opposed to exporting energy, we have this technological lead, we have this military lead. You know, our military before President Trump came in the first term was substantially run down. And you were talking about China earlier. And if I think, what are the three things that China envies the U.S. for? It's our military. I think our military is more powerful and more lethal and more respected than it's ever been. I think that our technology, that the U.S. leads the world, and we just keep pulling away. That now, with this AI boom, we're going to have over 70 or 80% of all the compute in the world, up from 40 or 50 a few years ago, is going to be in the U.S. And then the economy, the Europeans celebrated 0.3% growth.
I don't think we celebrate that, but we
I didn't say the UK. The EU celebrated 0.3% growth that was better than expected. And I think once things get back to normal after this conflict, that the U.S. is going to grow at 3%, so 10x.
I guess the debt is higher, the oil reserves suddenly lower.
But the debt to GDP, which is important, deficit to GDP, debt to GDP is higher everywhere in the world.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a post-GFC fact. That is a post-COVID fact. So in terms of relative strength, I think we're much better shape.
As we do wrap up, final questions for you, Mr. Secretary. This is something we ask everyone on the Master Investor podcast, which is, as you know from the intro, I like to try and give our listeners an edge. And to wrap up, what is the overriding piece of investment advice you have for our listeners? We often ask for career advice too, and you're more than qualified to cover both topics for us.
Well, I'll do the career advice first. Is career advice, you never know what's going to happen. You never know what's going to happen. You know, I started out Yale 1980. I didn't know journalists, computer scientists, computer. I think you're too young to remember. Computers used to have these cumbersome things called punch cards. And when I got to Yale, we just switched to screens. And so being a computer scientist was miserable. I didn't become editor of the Yale Daily News, which was the best thing I ever lost. But I did an internship in finance and realized that the quantitative side and the qualitative side, the quantitative side of the computing, qualitative side of a narrative is actually what the investment business is all about. You know, you think about scenarios and then can you prove it? And then in terms of investing, I tell everyone, you have to know what level of risk you're willing to take. You have to do what you're comfortable with. And you just shouldn't get out over your skis. Like that's the main thing. You never want to have to sell at the bottom. You never want to find yourself like chasing at the top.
Is America out over its skis in the Middle East right now?
Absolutely not. As I said, we are every day we are moving ahead of plan, and the Iran is the degraded. There was a message from the bunker from the new Ayatollah. We haven't seen him, so let's see if we see him.
You suggesting he's no longer alive?
Is he compos menace? Is he injured? Is he under threat from the other members of the regime?
Do you think regime change is on the cards in the days ahead then?
Our goals are the three that I talked about, but once these things go in motion, you never know what's going to happen. They take on a life of their own beneath the surface.
I can see we're very, very much out of time, Mr. Secretary. I really do appreciate all of your time in Canada today, not least because, as you proved in the middle of the interview, we know how busy you are now more than ever. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to see you.
The Master Investor podcast is sponsored by BNY Investments, LSEG, and Interactive Brokers. Please do remember the views expressed in this podcast are for general information purposes only. Nothing in the podcast constitutes a financial promotion, investment advice, or a personal recommendation. More on that in the show notes. This podcast is produced by Paradigm Productions and Master Investor Limited in association with Birdline Media. If you've enjoyed the show, please do subscribe on YouTube or click follow on your podcast platform, and you'll be automatically notified each time a new episode drops.